This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Yesterday I did Gucci, so and today Fendi, so
it's hot.
Hey, it's Nikki Jensen
and Brie Piccone,
and we're
Late to the party,
a weekly podcast about film, fashion, and pop culture from two best friends mentally telling Nick Cage to snap out of it in 1987. And today we are with a very special guest all the way from Australia. I almost tried to attempt to do an Aussie accent, but I will refrain. The host of Podcast Around the Corner, a Nora Ephron podcast, Shawnee Mead. Hey.
Hey. Hi. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm so excited to be here and talk all about Cher and Moonstruck and all that. And thank you for not doing an accent.
Do you get that a lot?
Not really, but often, sometimes if I travel, people try and do an accent, but yeah. Usually it's me having to put on an accent because people don't understand what I'm saying.
Well, we've seen the Mary-Kate and Ashley classic, Our Lips Are Sealed, so we got you. We know all there is to know about Aussies. We love the Veronicas growing up, so we got you.
Yeah.
But yes, today we are talking about Moonstruck, starring Cher. So what is your relationship with this film?
I think I saw it. Oh, I don't even remember. I think the first time I saw it maybe 10 years ago, I think. I feel like maybe I'd vaguely seen it before as a kid. But yeah, I watched it as an adult for the first time then, and I just completely fell in love with it because I love, well, it's sort of like a traditional rom-com, but also it feels a bit like it's got some fairy tale sort of elements thrown in with all the stuff and the moon and, you know, everything. And I, yes, yes, there's a wolf in you. All that, but yeah, I just feel like it's a really magical sort of movie. But I love that there is like a romantic love story element, but it's also about a love story between, you know, members of the family. And just I love that it's just about the community as well, which that, you know, I love you to see around the community, to seeing all the different shops and all the different, you know, all their neighbors. I just really love that. And, you know, Cher and Nicolas Cage just bounce off each other so well. It's just they're a perfect pairing in this.
They are. And I know Cher really pushed to have Nick Cage star in this movie. Mm.
Yeah, because I think the filmmakers thought he was too young. And she was like, no, he's going to be able to do it. He is. I mean, no one else could have brought that level of chaos that it needed for the role. But also, he's still endearing. But yeah, he's definitely in like full-on Cage chaos mode.
Yes.
I love his monologues when he just like goes off the rails.
My hand. but it's funny that you mention the little like elements of like the neighborhood and the family, which, you know, we just rewatched Moonstruck for this podcast. And this is the first time because we're speaking with you and you talk Nora Ephron on your podcast. Do you see any similarities? Because now that I'm thinking about it, the world building is very similar to like a You've Got Mail.
Yes. I feel like they are very similar because it's, well, one, it's the New York setting, but it's also, yes, it's in the city and it's in Brooklyn as well, but it has a very like neighborhood sort of feel, like you kind of go further away from the city part of it and you're in the kind of suburban parts of the neighborhood. And yeah, it's just kind of every character, even if they're in it for a couple of minutes or have one line or they're just someone walking along, they always feel like real people. Like it definitely, the world building in this is spot on. Like it feels very real. And yeah, the relationships between people and the kind of script itself has a very Nora kind of feel to it. The way people talk, the kind of funny quips that people make. And yeah, and I feel like it's also very similar to Joan Micklyn Silver's film Crossing Delancey, because that's also set in New York. And that has that vibe that it's about relationships between people, the neighborhood, that sort of thing. And yeah, I just really, I feel like this definitely has Nora vibes for me.
For sure. Well, like a Nora Ephron film, I was like, I turned over to Brie and I was like, this film is really mature. I don't know what that says about the movies that I watch, but it's the way it handles love and relationships and those dynamics and family. Mm. It's really mature. Yeah.
Mm. Like her relationship with Johnny. I feel like the way they handle the relationship with Johnny is kind of similar to like in You've Got Mail, how Meg Ryan's character, it like breaks up with her boyfriend at that time. They're like, you know, this isn't working, is it? Okay. You know, like that just mature level of handling relationships.
Yeah. And I think because she feels like she's been married before, her husband died, and she's kind of like, well, you know, I've had my kind of love story and now I'll just, you know, he's a nice guy, I'll just marry him. But then she meets, you know, the brother and it's all just fireworks and chaos, and but they actually work really well together, and it sort of, you know, kind of wakes her up again and brings like, it makes her realize again that she can, you know, have a love story, not just settle for kind of a companion or just being comfortable. She can,
she can let her freak flag fly.
Yeah, well, it seems like, because in the beginning of the movie we meet Cher's character Loretta and her boyfriend, who is just a putz. A lovable putz. Yes. And like, he can't even propose right. Like the whole restaurant and Loretta are like telling him how to propose. He can't order for himself.
He doesn't have a ring. He's like just ridiculous.
Yes. Well, on the Cher topic, I feel like this is Cher as an actress. Her, well, this is the one she wins the Oscar for one thing. But it's it's just the one most synonymous with Cher as far as an actor. But what's your favorite Cher performance?
I think this is definitely one of my favorite Cher performances. I also really love her in Mermaids. Mm-hmm. She's like, I love her character in that. She's really great in that. But also, which is one I hadn't seen before, but we watched it for the Nora podcast, but in Silkwood, like, she is absolutely brilliant in that. Like, yes, it's kind of, you know, Meryl's show, but Cher is, you know, phenomenal in that. That was actually her first kind of really serious acting role, and she just like straight out of the gate, she was just a complete natural. But
she's a really good actor,
I think, because she's and I think a lot of people do that, or like, you know, singers moving into acting, but actually she just, I think she was always a performer, she's a big personality, and she just fits, put Cher in to kind of get, you know, people to watch the movie, and go, and she's not very good, but she's always brilliant, I think. But
I agree.
My favorite Cher is Silkwood. I think she's phenomenal in that movie.
Yeah.
I think anytime,
especially because she's not very glam. She's not very glam in Silkwood, which from my research, she kind of, Meryl said that Cher was like really uncomfortable with that, but she kind of just, you know, got over it and really just got into the character. And by the end, she didn't care that she didn't have any makeup on and had kind of drab hair and clothes, and because she just really, you know, got stuck in. So
yeah, I feel like anytime Cher is stripped down, you know it's going to be good. Like in the beginning of this film, you're like, this is going to win the Oscar because she's stripped down.
Yes. And back when the Academy would actually consider rom-coms for awards.
Bring that back. Yeah. And bring back good rom-coms.
I know. Well, that's kind definitely of a lost art.
Yes, it definitely is. But yeah, but I mean, Meg's coming back. Meg Ryan's bringing a rom-com back this year, so.
I know. What do you think about that?
I am so excited. I mean, I'm excited, but I'm going to have to wait longer than my American friends because it doesn't have a release date in Australia. So I'm like, everyone's going to be talking about it, and I'm going to be like, I haven't seen it. But I'm really excited about it. And from what I've heard, it's very kind of Nora. You can tell that she was inspired by Nora, which I think, in the film, I think she dedicated the film to Nora or something. Mm. But I think she really brought, you know, all of her rom-com expertise.
It's definitely one of those like Nora Ephron premises, which is like cemented as like the rom-com premise in my mind, where it's like you're stuck in an airport. Yes. It's like this random situation.
Mm. And really, yeah, then it means it's pretty much just all about the dialogue, which Nora was all about that. That was her. Yeah, the dialogue was the most important thing. So I like that Meg's kind of gone that route as well with this movie. But, you know, I feel hopeful for the state of the rom-com if, you know, Meg is returning to us in our time of need.
Sure.
Try to stay hopeful.
Yeah. Well, speaking of dialogue, this film has some really great monologues, starting, I think, with the, well, because the plot of the film, it's Cher is going to marry Johnny. His wish when he's going to his dying mom in Sicily is that Cher invites his brother Ronnie to the wedding. And so she goes to Ronnie, and Ronnie's there in the bakery with his like hand.
Yeah.
So he has a monologue there, and then it just ensues. What are your thoughts on the opening intro to Ronnie Johnny?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, especially for a Nicolas Cage character, like it seems like a perfect way to meet him. But I mean, straight away, it just lays out why the brothers haven't spoken, why, you know, and also I think because Johnny's a coward, he's left it up to Loretta to have to sort it out because he doesn't want to have to go and apologize and deal with his bakery madness. But yeah, I think it's a perfect, because it lays out that, you know, he's had a thing against Johnny forever because he had a fiance, and then for some reason Johnny distracted him or something and his hand was chopped off in the bread cutter. So he has a wooden hand and, you know, goes around yelling things like, you know, I lost my hand, I lost my bride, and like that. And then the bit when he yells to the woman in the bakery, like, Chrissy, get me the big knife. And clearly you can tell Chrissy's, he's asking Chrissy that all the time. And she's like, I won't do it. And even her bit when she's like, you know, I'm in love with this man and he doesn't even know it. And like, I just, Chrissy, just my like heart goes out to Chrissy in the few moments that we meet her. But
yeah, but talk about just a toxic work environment.
Yes. Cause he's like yelling and screaming. And I feel like everyone in the bakery just kind of is just like on eggshells with him all the time. But, you know, but Loretta's tough. She doesn't put up with this shit. And then
she's not even fazed.
Yeah. End up. Yeah. And then they end up in his apartment, and then she's, you know, yelling at him about being a wolf without a foot, and he's yelling at her, a bride without a head. It's very, but yes, from that chaos, they kind of, you know, clearly they just mesh really well together. I think they understand each other, and they don't just, she won't put up with his stuff, and, you know, he needs that because otherwise he's just running around yelling about the big knife all the time. So. Yeah.
And also he kind of tells her what to do, which obviously she doesn't get a lot.
Or like gives, he, I feel like he also gives her permission to kind of not like be so, I don't know, to let go a bit, let loose, like just live life, like be imperfect maybe.
Yeah.
To do the wrong thing. Like
he, and I think he kind of, makes her remember that she can actually live her life with, you know, some passion, some gusto. She doesn't just have to go along kind of being just stuck in a rut, sort of. She can be a big, powerful person that she has been all along. But yeah, I think they really complement each other perfectly. They bring out the good things in each other and kind of tamp down maybe the, like, you know, more chaotic parts. Because he does seem a lot calmer when they're together.
Definitely. I love when he throws the table across the room and grabs her and kisses her. And she's like, wait. And then it's, and then she kisses him. So it's like she's making the choice for herself. It's very, like I said before, mature. It's interesting.
Yes. And then a bit sort of like really dramatic, but also a bit silly. And then the way she's just like, take me to the bed. And then he's like, it's just that whole bit's kind of, it is mature, but it's also silly as well. Like it just that bit. It's really funny. And then the next, you know, morning when he's like, I love you, and she's like, snap out of it.
Slaps him.
I love that bit.
Like, iconic.
Slaps him. I love that bit. But
well, I think Gene Siskel even said that it was a comedy. Sorry.
I was saying then his love for opera, which is like, you know, I think also feeds into his chaos because opera is very chaotic. But,
are you guys opera fans?
Definitely.
I am.
Yes, sort of. I haven't really been to that many, but
I've fallen asleep in an opera. Does that count?
You're not crying.
Like, you were there.
I haven't seen La Boheme though. So
no, I haven't either.
I've seen Rent. Does that count?
Maybe. I mean, rock opera, that counts.
And also around this time, where there's this theme of the moon.
Yes.
Let's talk about the moon.
I love that that's a theme.
Yeah, I love the moon in this. And I also love the way that especially that one scene where it's nighttime and everyone's looking at the moon, that it's this like comically large moon that's just like out everyone's window, and it's like this massive ginormous moon is just everywhere. And but I love how that's when like the fairy tale element comes into it, that sort of everything's kind of normal but then the moon is there. And like I especially love Loretta's uncle going, "It's Cosmo's moon," and then he's like, "The moon, and look at you, like you're so beautiful and you look like you're 16 all over again." Like I just, and she's kind of first of all thinks he's being silly, and then she's just like enchanted by that because he just, he's so excited about the moon. And and the grandpa that he's out with the dogs, like looking at the moon, and he's, I mean, the grandpa is hilarious. He's always just wandering around with his dogs, hanging out with his mates in the cemetery with all the dogs.
You could say they are moonstruck.
You could.
Yes. Yes. Yes, you could. Maybe they could have should have named the movie that.
I know.
Yeah.
But it was going to be called The Wolf and the Bride, or The Bride and the Wolf.
Yeah, that doesn't really
have
work.
The same ring.
Not the same.
No. And it makes it sound like it's sort of a, I don't know, like a period drama, or like a, like, you
Beauty
know,
and the Beast or something.
Gods and wizards and like a fantasy sort of. Yeah, it doesn't really. But yeah, I do love how that brings in like the big sort of fantasy element, that the moon is sort of the thing that's making everything happen and that's making everyone kind of let go of their, you know, inhibitions and stuff. And it's just the moon, it's magic.
It's such a whimsical way of, because when we're talking about like full moons, usually it's like you go crazy on the full moon, but at least with this, it's like, it's like whimsical, and or it's like bringing out your,
yeah,
your like purest, like your true self, like that dark side that you like hide.
Yeah. And Loretta keeps trying to, once she and Ronnie, that, you know, sort of together, but then she feels guilty because, you know, she's engaged to his brother who's in Sicily, who keeps calling ridiculously all the time, and his mother, who apparently is dying, is actually not. And now she's like, she's up, she's getting up, she's walking around, she's cooking. Like, I think he's actually just, we just make him seem completely pathetic. But she keeps then trying to tell, you know, Ronnie that they shouldn't be together, and then he goes like, but love's not meant to be nice, like it's meant to break our hearts, and
yeah,
all of that bit. And he has to kind of go, stop just going back to how it was before, like we can have a life together that's exciting, and I know that you want that as well, but you're trying to, you know, go back to how it was before. Yeah. And I love when they go to the opera, and then, yeah, she kind of like gives herself permission to get glam. Like she goes to the salon, she gets her hair done, she like buys a fancy new dress, and
I love the makeover scene.
And like she's giving herself permission to sort of be herself again, I think. Yeah, I love, and the way she just has the fire on and she's just, you know, spreading out her clothes and just like being at one with letting herself glam it up for the opera.
Definitely. I think it's really interesting in that initial meeting with Loretta and Ronnie in the kitchen, how Loretta is like, I know who you are, Ronnie. Like, you're this wolf and you bit your own hand off because you were afraid. And she's very astute. Like, she's correct about that. But then we spend the rest of the movie with Loretta and how she's learning to be vulnerable and live and love herself.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's funny the way she's bringing up, like, you know, there's a wolf in you, which is funny because she heard that from that couple at the liquor store that she stopped in one night and got like a bottle of wine or something, and the wife was going, you know, there's a wolf in you, and then they're having this sort of funny little conversation where the couple are then laughing. So I love that she heard that from them and then met Ronnie, and that's where I was like, oh, I totally get the there's a wolf in you thing, because I've met someone that fits that whole thing. And yeah,
it's pretty hairy. Going, like, at least, you know, it's just like, I don't know, it kind of looks like a wolf, but like it's kind of hot.
It's giving Wolverine. Oh, but back to the makeover very, before like, the opera.
Nicolas Cage hair. Yeah. Yes, that is. That's such a great scene. Like, I really just, I love that scene. And then she's just like full on Cher from then on.
What is your relationship with Cher, by the way? Like, do you love her music or just her film work? What's your Cherography?
My Cherography. Yeah, I do like her music, but I think most of my relationship with Cher is through her acting. Like, when I was a kid, I watched Mermaids all the time because it's one of my mom's favorites, and we'd watch it together. So yeah, I think I saw that tons. So that was like my first experience to Cher. And then my mom really loved the Sonny and Cher show when it was on, and then when it first came out on DVD, we got those, so we'd watch all of those together. So then I got like a intro to pre sort of 90s Cher. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do like her music as well. It's not, I do think I prefer her Cher as an actress rather than a singer. Like, her music's not totally my style, but it's still great. But yeah. And I mean, that the Oscars, you know, in 88 when she won the Oscar for Moonstruck, I mean, that outfit she had on, that Bob Mackie beaded dress, is just like, it's fabulous, that dress.
Yeah. No, she's definitely a style icon. I think
she
can still
get into it. Yeah, she definitely is.
I feel like I just grew up on her music, and like 90s Cher was kind of like, is what I came into consciousness. Yes. So
yeah.
Same. Yes. I think that was probably like the first auto-tune I'd ever like, you know, come across that.
Yeah. Probably. Or like the Cher greatest hits, because my mom looks like Cher a little bit. So she, growing up, it was all Cher all the time.
She was obsessed with Cher too.
Yeah. Just lots of gypsies, tramps, and thieves around my house. But also Moonstruck, because Italian American. So,
I mean, Cher's not even Italian, but she's very convincingly Italian.
Yes. But it's hard to believe, but I think we just accepted her. We're just like, okay. It's like Snooki. We just say, we know you're not, but you are. Yeah. I can't believe I just compared Cher and Snooki. I'm so sorry.
I've been watching a lot of Jersey Shore.
Hot takes. Yeah. Here on Late to the Party.
Yeah. We try to have hot takes.
Maybe not so much of a hot take. I can't help but watch like this movie in Silkwood and think of A Star is Born.
Yeah.
Like Gaga's acting turn.
Like a singer turned actor.
Yeah, I haven't really seen much of Lady Gaga's sort of acting output, but from what I've heard, it is kind of the Cher thing that, you know, she actually just naturally just really takes to acting. I mean, she always almost plays kind of Cher kind of roles, I feel, like everything that Lady Gaga's been in. I think because like Cher, she's also a big personality, so she just...
Yeah, it's like when they strip down. That's when the acting comes out, which I love. Speaking of performances, can we talk Nick Cage, the Wolf, which is this his debut or his, I guess, breakthrough role?
Yes.
What are your thoughts on Nick Cage? I think this is him at his like perfect Nick Cage temperature.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's done a lot of action films and stuff like that, but I always feel like Nicolas Cage is best in kind of rom-com mode, like, because there's another film, It Could Happen to You, where he and Bridget Fonda win the lottery, and that's got like a very New York fairy tale sort of feel as well. But I feel like, yeah, that's definitely one to check out. That's also a good 90s film. But I mean, sometimes in things he's almost like too chaotic, but yeah, I think it's the right balance in this, and also it works in this because the film has kind of a hyper real quality to it at times. So the fact that he is such like a heightened character, it works in this. And I feel like if they'd asked another actor to kind of try and bring that energy to this film, it would have come off as sort of comical, like, or it felt like they were trying too hard to be just, you know, this big, massive character. But I think he just...
It's naturally chaotic.
I think it's just natural. It's just natural to him to bring the chaos.
I love that about him.
But yeah, Moonstruck is definitely that right amount of chaos.
Yeah. Yeah, because otherwise, like, he can then veer into, like, face-off territory where it's just, like, completely just, like, off the map
chaos. John Travolta, or is it John Travolta?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, he's also chaotic. He brings that same energy.
Yes. But yeah, Nicolas Cage in face-off is just, like, off the walls.
Not everyone can bring that kind of chaos.
And then other films like, yeah, no, they can't. And then oddly in Con Air, everyone else is bringing the chaos and his character is sort of calm.
Ooh.
It's like, and really John Malkovich is doing the Nicolas Cage kind of role in that.
Interesting. Yeah. That's another one I want to see.
Nicolas Cage is very much like the hero of the film. Because, yeah, it's about a plane filled with all these dangerous convicts, but then he's on the plane as well, but I think he's going to be released, but he's just on this plane and the others are being moved to, like, you know, high security facilities. But they're all pretty scary dudes and they all take over the plane. And then Nicolas Cage has to try and save the day with all those, you know, gifs where he's got really long hair, like, blowing in the breeze. Yes. That's
and he doesn't bring the chaos.
No, he's actually quite normal, like action hero, in that everyone else is bringing the chaos.
I feel like Con Air is one of those movies, like at the Blockbuster, you know, when they would show on the TVs a random movie. That's one of those for me. Where I'm just like, oh, I've seen his flowing locks, but I can't read the dialogue. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's definitely a, you know, it's fun. It's very one of those, like, you know, high concept, elevator pitch kind of 90s movies that it's all just there. It says it on the tin what it is, and it's just...
It's perfect. I mean, Nicolas Cage and Cher are a really great match for each other, especially in that opera scene where it's... Yes. They have all this intensity before, but then it's just such a sweet and tender moment when she turns over to him and she has like tears in her eyes and he like holds her hand.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's watching her because I think he says that, you know, he only has two loves in his life, and it's opera and her. So I think the fact that she's so taken with opera as well, because she hasn't been before. So the fact that she is so like overwhelmed by like, you know, the beauty, but the sadness of the opera. And I do love that moment where he sort of just looks at her and she's kind of like, I get it, that life like should be beautiful and chaotic. And yeah. And I don't really feel like I notice the age difference that much, but I think some people will talk about it, but like, who cares?
Not as much as with her and like the other guy, Johnny.
Yeah, he even seems too old for Cher, but I know Cher's like 40 in this film.
Yeah, and I think Nicolas Cage was like 23 or something.
Yeah.
But
yeah. You can't tell though. Like, Cher just looks so fabulous.
Yes, yes, definitely. And another performance that I really love, Olympia Dukakis as Cher's mother.
Yes. As
Rose. I think she was nominated for an Oscar as well for supporting actress, but
I believe she won. Yes, she won. And it's an Oscar well deserved.
Yeah, definitely. But she is so brilliant in that. And a lot of her dialogue is kind of very Nora, like she gets all the kind of dialogue about differences between men and women, and the fact that every man she meets, she's always asking, why do men chase women? And she's always just like, I want someone to give me the answer and no one will. And then someone finally says, it's because, you know, we fear death. And she's like, aha, finally, like, someone has like given me the answer.
That is such a Nora Ephronism.
She's just perfect in that. Like, it's very, you know, actually when Harry Met Sally came after this, but yeah, it's that very kind of just exploring the full-on differences between men and women and how they interact and how they interact in the world. But yeah, she's fabulous in that. And I really love the scene with her and John Mahoney.
That's my favorite.
Yes, but yeah, he's the guy that it's this restaurant that the family go to all the time, and it's this guy that he's always there with much younger women, and then they always end up getting up from the table and screaming and throwing them water in his face. He's just that guy. But then yeah, one night Rose is there kind of by herself for dinner, and then another girl storms out and throws water in his face. But then he and Rose end up having dinner together, and you know, and then she goes like, you know, what you don't understand about women is a lot.
But,
And then he's kind of
You're probably gonna mention it. Yeah
and then he kind of wants to walk her home, and then he's sort of like, you can tell that he then really likes her, and she's like, but you might be a man, but you kind of just act like a little boy. And and I have a family and I'm married, so I'm
she's like, I'm not doing that. I'm classy, too classy for that. I know who I am.
Yeah, she does. She says, I know who I am.
Yeah. And I just really, everything about her role is perfect. And then, you know, the final role in the kitchen at home.
There's like a complete story she tells just by like the look in her eyes and the way
I mean, she's yelling at Loretta, like, what are you doing? Because, the stupid dad is, you know, having an affair with some other lady. And then Rose is sort of knows about it. But then he's kind of like, it doesn't matter. And she's like, no, it does matter, because, like, you're throwing my life away as well. And, like, the family we've built together. And then when she goes, do you love him, Loretta? And she's like, yeah, I love him awful. And she's like, oh. Dude, that's too bad.
Yes. It's like the perfect ending line for her too. But I'm even captivated by, well, even at the table at dinner, the John Mahoney monologue about why he chases the younger girls. It actually opened my eyes a lot to this concept of the fear of death, but also that he and his students sees like the youth in their eyes and wants just a little bit of that.
Chasing that youthful feeling.
Do we have any thoughts? Because even Loretta's dad, who's cheating on Olympia Dukakis's character, his problem is a fear of death too. Mm-hmm. He just wants to feel.
Is it because men die earlier than women? You know, because the ladies don't seem quite as preoccupied. Well, probably. I mean, you know, I don't know. Mm. Thinking out loud here.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that whole concept? Because I feel like it's a good portion of Moonstruck.
Yeah, I do think that's an interesting point. I mean, you know, not being a man myself, I don't really know their whole fear of death thing because I don't. Yeah, maybe it is a men die younger than women. I don't know.
Is it also like accomplishment based, you think? Because like the
John Mahoney's
John
character?
Mahoney. Yeah. I wanted to say John Goodman, but I knew that was wrong. Sorry. Cause I keep thinking that Loretta's dad looks like John Goodman. So I don't know, thinking about him in the back of my brain. But John Mahoney, he's a professor. So he's talking about like all the knowledge he has and stuff and how the younger girls are looking at him like, I don't know, like he's the smartest man in the world or something. And then Loretta's father says something about like, what is my life? Like, I haven't done anything with my life. And then her mom's like, yeah, you have. Like, I don't know. So maybe it's also like something with that, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Men are weird. I don't
know. So you're Olivia Dukakis's, I don't know. Like, you're on her camp, on her side?
Yeah, I think I'm her, like, you know, what you don't know about women is a lot. Guy, like I'm in that group, but yeah, I mean, it feels like every man in the movie except for Loretta's uncle and the grandpa, like they don't seem to care about, you know, fear of death. Mm-hmm. The uncle, like, you know, he still loves his wife, he still, when he sees her, he still sees, you know, the teenage version of her that he fell in love with all those years ago, and he still just adores her and she adores him. So mm-hmm. I love them as a pair. And I mean, the grandpa's just doing his own thing. He's just wandering around, him and his dog, staring up at the moon. Like, he doesn't seem to care about, and he's, you know, the oldest person in the movie. He doesn't seem to care about that, but yeah.
He has all the tea.
Yes. Yeah, he's just wandering around, like, you know, he sees Rose out the front with John Mahoney, and he's kind of like, I see you. She's like, I see you. Like, you know, if you feed that dog my food one more time, I'm like, you know, I'm going to get you, old man. Like, she's kind of like, don't bring the noise at me.
Yes. I love at the end when he starts to cry at the dinner table and he's like, I'm just so confused.
Yeah.
Because he also can't and speak English. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he can a little bit, but it's like he didn't need to because all his mates, they're all Italian as well, and they just hang out together all the time. And mostly he just talks to the dogs. So.
Yeah. Well, let's then talk about the final dinner scene where everything comes to a head.
Like, it's one of the best scenes. Yes.
Yeah, I love that scene with the breakfast one where it's sort of like Loretta has rushed in because it's the night after the opera and she sort of rushed in and she's still in the outfit from last night, and then Johnny's coming home and like it's all just chaos. It's chaotic. And Ronnie's there and then everyone is there, and then I love how while this chaos is going on, Rose is still just making people breakfast. Like, she's just, you know, cooking up all these like egg sandwiches.
Like, do you want oatmeal?
On the stove while she's, you know, yelling at her husband, and she's like laying down the law, like, don't say things like you haven't done anything with your life, because like, what does that mean for me? Like, I'm part of your life, and that means what, that I'm nothing? And yeah, and then the grandpa comes in, and then Ronnie's there, and then yeah, John yelling about the mother's not dead and he's so excited, which then she doesn't mind because she wants to break up with him, and then Ronnie proposes, and then it's all just, but then weirdly it's like Johnny's still like part of the family, even though he's now not going to marry Loretta. It's kind of like, yeah, he's awkward. Just there. He gets the champagne, like, you know, we're all. And then the uncle and auntie come in because the night before, because Cher is an accountant and does like the books for all these mm-hmm. businesses, but she came and took their like day's takings the day before. And then it's sort of, they're worried that she's stolen their money. And she's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like, I've got the money here. And it's like, she gets it out of a person. So then they just sit down and they're all just like, okay. And then, you know, they get engaged and everyone's just sitting there having mm-hmm. breakfast around the table. And just, I really love that scene because it's just, it combines all of the, you know, family love story with the romantic love story, and it all just ties it off with like a neat little bow.
It does. Well, I feel like it's a very 80s trope as well, which I love, of like everyone just coming together at the end. It's like a play, almost.
Mm.
And I love that. The theater nerd me love that.
I love how like quickly the engagement is called off and then a new engagement's called back on. Like it happens so fast, like within like a couple minutes.
Yeah.
And everyone's pretty cool with it.
And then she gives Johnny his ring back. Yeah. And it's like, even Johnny's kind of okay with it because he was sort of like, I guess like, you know, my mother's not dead. So now I don't need to rush and get married to make my mother happy. But yeah. And then she gives Johnny back his ring. And then Ronnie proposes and then goes like, give me that ring back. So then she's got the ring, the same ring again for it, you know, now engaged to a different brother.
I love that.
Oh, well, just everyone else is in their pajamas.
Just a casual, like, Saturday morning.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you know. I mean, they all just take it in their stride. Like, none of the rest of the family feel like it's... They just kind of go with it.
They bust open the champagne at the end. I don't know.
I love the grandpa, like, telling Johnny, like, come here, have some, because you're a part of the family now.
Yeah. Which I feel like he needs to be taken in by someone, because he's...
Yeah.
He's just a bit sort of pathetic and like he needs people to tell him what to do. So I think he needs to be like taken in by a family because he's just, you know, he's a bit useless, but in a lovable way, but he's definitely a useless kind of guy.
Yeah.
Which, good morning, by the way. It's so different because it's like nighttime for us.
Yeah.
Good morning to you.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yes. I'm in the future. I'm tomorrow. Nothing exciting has happened yet, but I can keep you posted.
Sounds good.
There's, you know, anything that pops up that you need to know for your tomorrow. But but it's 11 o'clock here, so 11 o'clock a.m. in the future.
Nice. I feel like that's like a theme, like loosely in Moonstruck too. It's like it's revolved around the moon, not time. But I think it's so fascinating how it's like...
Yes.
What am I trying to say? Do you know what I mean? Like the theme is very much...
The moon, it almost... It's like time almost doesn't exist in this movie for a moment. And it's just about the moon. I don't know.
Mm.
Like, and the moon stays full for like a couple of nights, which it doesn't usually happen. But you suspend the disbelief. Mm. So.
But you also never see the moon that big because the moon is like massive. Every time you see the moon in this movie, it's almost like it's almost hilarious how big the moon is.
Yes.
It's just like, you know, it's just looming in there in the window. Like the moon definitely becomes like its own character. I feel like the moon's like the main character, really. But
pretty much. It's like Cher, the moon, and Nick Cage are like the stars of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
The moon should win an Oscar.
Oscar for the moon.
Well, speaking of Oscars, it was nominated for 6 Oscars at the 1988 Academy Awards. And of course, Cher won Best Actress. But Olympia Dukakis won Supporting Actress. And the Best Original Screenplay went to Moonstruck as well.
Well, that's really cool. I mean, the script is brilliant and I love that, and it has similarities to John Patrick Shanley's other scripts because he also wrote Joe versus the Volcano, which brought us the first Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks cinematic pairing, that came out in 1990. But yeah, there's the moon plays kind of a big part in that film as well.
He's just a moon guy.
Yeah, I think a lot of chaotic, but I just really love his script. They're quirky. They always have kind of like a fantastical sort of element to them. But I mean, that's odd because he wrote films like that. But he also wrote the screenplay for Doubt with Meryl Streep and Amy Adams. So it's like right on the.
That's kind of... so interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think actually he wrote the play of Doubt because it was a play first and then he turned it into a movie. Which, when you were saying before about the breakfast scene feeling sort of theatrical, he is a playwright as well, so that, you know, that makes sense that he'd kind of write theatrical kind of elements in as well. But yeah, I think he's just a big moon guy.
I love that. I also love in this film how it's almost like there's this fantastical event with the moon, but it's like a different path these characters can go down. Like they can either have these affairs or they can have an affair like the dad and course correct, or they can choose a different brother to love that's more like brings out the, you know,
choices.
Yeah, the moon's kind of just like opening it up and going, you know, it's moonstruck time. You can kind of do whatever. I'm giving you all the options. You're just
for sure.
Yeah, then I think the kind of chaos of the moon ebbs a bit, and then everyone kind of lands at the end kind of where they should be, and everything's sorted out. Like there aren't any affairs anymore. They're all done.
And hopefully it stays that way.
No.
Hopefully the moon doesn't rile them up again.
Yes.
The following month or something. I don't know.
Yes, I hope so. In their massive house in Brooklyn, which I think that house, that was the exterior of the house, I think it was up for sale a few years ago, and it was like really expensive. I think it was it went up for auction because everyone was like, the moonstruck house. Yeah. But also I think it's like a massive, because I don't think they just live in like one apartment in this building. I feel like they kind of live in like at least one of the floors or both floors.
Yeah.
Pretty much the whole family lives there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like they own this entire building. So
I know it kind of looks like the Hey Arnold apartment.
It does.
Yes.
Yeah. That's actually what I picture them now. I picture if any of them are still alive, like the fictional Moonstruck characters. I feel like the grandpa probably passed away and they just made it like a room and board. And John Mahoney's there. Renting a room, being weird.
Yeah, apparently it's a 4-story townhouse and it was listed for $12 million.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
In February. And then, apparently it was bought by Amy Schumer.
Oh, whoa.
Wow.
But okay. Apparently last year, I think she bought it. But yeah, I suppose if it's a, you know, 4-story, if you're buying the whole thing, $12 million. And,
nice.
Good for Amy Schumer.
I know. Let her live her moonstruck.
Bray Street.
Is it in Brooklyn?
Yeah, it is in Brooklyn. Yeah, Brooklyn Heights.
Okay.
Cranberry Street.
Ooh.
Cool. Cool street. Cranberry Street. It sounds lovely.
Cranberry Street. Sounds like a Taylor Swift kind of street.
She it does. Yes. Got Cornelia Street, got Cranberry Street.
Yes.
That's where people get moonstruck.
Maybe that.
Have affairs.
Well, maybe that'll be Taylor's song about Travis.
Yes.
Cranberry Street.
Yeah. Never know.
Yeah. So. Never know. Is Moonstruck a Christmas movie or a New Year's movie? Where do we classify this?
I feel like it's one I don't really classify it as being a holiday movie. But yeah, then I watch it every time. I go, oh yeah, it does actually have some Christmas. It's around Christmas time, but I just never think of it as that. Yeah, I think I always just forget those elements of it. And then people go, oh, it could be a Christmas film. And then I go, oh yeah. It could be. Yeah. It's not like, you know, like While You Were Sleeping, like films like that, that instantly my brain goes like, that's a Christmas movie. It's not. Moonstruck doesn't.
I feel like it gives New Year energy, though. Like,
yeah.
Like fresh beginnings, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the moon represents something. I don't know. Something about it. Because isn't it also in between the time of Christmas and New Year's?
Or yes. That odd time. That's also a time which feels like anything can happen. It's like a it's a weird period of time too.
Yeah, because it always feels like we're just like in limbo.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Some of the characters are in this movie, I feel, to a degree. Yes. Until they, you know, wrap it up at the end, then they figure things out. But they are in this limbo for most of the film.
Yeah.
It's just interesting they chose that time, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a weird sort of like liminal space of time that's like a weird. I mean, I think in Australia at that time feels even stranger because usually people are on holiday then, but I know in the States, you know, it's sort of Christmas and then everyone goes back to work because people have holidays in the summer and kids have to go back to school after Christmas. But we have, because it's summer here for Christmas, you know, that's when we take our holidays. So it's kind of, it feels even more sort of odd because pretty much everyone's like at home, businesses have closed for the week and everyone is kind of just floating around in this weird time. But I suppose in America, people are kind of just, you know, it's Christmas and then they're back to it. But we don't do that here.
You know what? It is more of like a holiday period for us too. But the sad part is the weather's not nice because it's winter, not summer. So it's just even more of a limbo. And then you go back to work. So
See, we have the reverse. We like always go, I want a snowy Christmas. I want a winter Christmas because, you know, we see so many Christmas films and Christmas songs and everything that it's, you know, it's snowing. It's a snowy Christmas. It's a white Christmas. But yeah, I've never had a white Christmas. And I definitely would like one at some point.
I'm just summer Christmas. Like in the movie The Holiday, we could holiday swap.
We could do that.
Well, I mean, here it doesn't snow.
At the end of so yeah, it still doesn't snow. But
that's sad. I'll have to find somewhere that snows and go hey, let's do a swap. Because I mean, people always want to come to Australia. People like the minute I tell people that I'm Australian, everyone's like, "Oh my god, that's so cool!" And I'm always like, more cool where you're from, but like anyway.
You gotta have like the perfect like Chicago Christmas. Yeah. Be like very Home Alone. The quintessential one.
Yes. Yes. But for the end of 2020, my mom and I were planning to, you know, do Christmas in New York, but clearly, you know, things happened in the world and that didn't happen. And you know, but it's definitely, you know, the New Yorkie Christmasness of it all, and to see the Rockefeller Center tree, and I've been there in November, just before the tree went up, and I'm always like, oh, I've always like I've missed that kind of
go ice skating.
Yes, I mean, I'm not really much of a skater, but I do like just sitting, you know, in the food court bit in the Rockefeller Center and just watching everyone in the ice rink. I could just sit there for hours because it's just soaking in all that snow and all the Christmas vibes and everything, but
it's magical. Yeah,
it's just other times I've been in the States for Halloween, so it's kind of to stay for Christmas would mean I'd be on holiday for about 3 months, and that doesn't work. So
no,
next time it will just have to be for Christmas.
Definitely. Well, any more Moonstruck talk before we wrap this thing up?
I feel like it's just a really special movie. Like, it's a little underrated. I don't know. Do people still think about Moonstruck?
I hope so.
I think people do. I feel like people talk about it a bit more. Like, it's getting a kind of Moonstruck renaissance sort of thing. But yeah, it definitely deserves more attention again. Like, I definitely hope more people see it because it's just... yeah, it's just a fantastic film. And it's just got everything. Like, the performances are amazing, but it's a really fantastic script as well. And it's just, yeah, it's kind of everything that you'd want a rom-com to be. Like, it's definitely
a classic. You know,
yeah.
It's up there. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely up there with, you know, Nora's films for me.
Definitely. Like,
you know, You've Got Mail, Moonstruck, Sleepless. They're all kind of, you know,
in the rotation. Delancey,
they're all up there. In the, like, you know, the top tier rom-com level. So
what is your favorite Nora Ephron film?
It's definitely You've Got Mail. That's always been my favorite. I think also just because I've always wanted to own a bookstore. So I just, like, you know, I've always wanted to be Kathleen Kelly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that even though I've seen there's some other Nora films I hadn't seen that I have for the podcast, but yeah, it's always going to be You've Got Mail for me. That's my fave.
Where do you stand on Julie and Julia?
I have only seen a couple of times. I do like it. But I feel like almost I'd like the movie more if it was just about Julia Child and you took away the Julie bit, but you know, I do like it. It is a good film. It's, you know, for Nora's final film, it's just so Nora because it's all just about food, and she loved Julia Child and she loved food, and it just probably the foodiest Nora film. But yeah, I do really like it as well. It's not my favorite, but it's definitely one of her really, you know, solid films. But
yeah,
I think it gets a bad rap, but I do agree about the Julia Child bit being leaps and bounds better than the Amy Adams portion.
Yeah. I think I just, every time I watch it, I'm like, I just want more of, like,
it's also Meryl Streep.
I don't
yeah. I always want more Meryl Streep in a movie.
I always think of when Meryl and Jane Lynch go too tall about, like, men.
Yes. I think it works perfectly that Meryl was in Nora Ephron's final film because, you know, Nora Ephron's first theatrical screenplay was Silkwood, so Meryl's in that. You know, Meryl played a version of Nora in Heartburn, so I think it works well as the Meryl sort of Nora trilogy, like tying the whole thing together. But yeah, I mean, I know it's not, I know I'm not interviewing you guys, but what are your favorite Nora films?
I also love You Got Mail. I feel like that one, trying to think what else. I like Harry, When Harry Met Sally.
That's like, Rob Reiner. Mm-hmm. But I think she wrote the... Does that count?
Yeah, no. We covered When Harry Met Sally. It definitely counts because, yeah, it was directed by Rob Reiner, but it's a Nora script. And Nora was really involved in the making of the film as well because, yeah, I think other films, she'd kind of write the film and then the director sort of, you know... She wasn't involved that much, or like My Blue Heaven, that she kind of felt like the director ruined her script because she wasn't involved in any way. But I mean, Rob Reiner really brought Nora into the whole process. And I mean, because Sally is based on Nora mm-hmm. as well, so it's kind of half her film. I think it definitely counts.
You've Got Mail or Heartburn is probably my pick.
I'm just always curious what people's favorite movies are.
Have you ever gotten Bewitched or Michael? Because those are wild ones.
No, but I personally love Bewitched. Justice for Bewitched. Like, I think it gets a bad rap and it doesn't deserve it. It's, you know.
I remember
it's
being
fun.
Cute.
And also I love that because she wrote it with her. Yeah. I think it's cute. And it's also really, it's got like layers of meta-ness because it's sort of, Nora wrote it with her sister Delia. And, you know, they brought in their experiences working in the entertainment industry. And I like that it's, you know, a film about, you know, a remake of a remake. Like, it, you know, it's all these layers. I really like it, but I know a lot of people are down on Bewitched, which is not fair.
It's got Will Ferrell, and, though.
I'm going to have to revisit it because I stan Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, and I think it's such a different Nicole Kidman sort of role, especially when you compare it to the other time she played a witch in Practical Magic. Like, they're just, you know, completely day and night sort of characters. But yeah, I just think it's cute. I don't get the problem. I don't understand. And yeah, our next episode is about Michael. Yeah, that was actually a really interesting one to cover because I'd seen that a lot as a kid, but I didn't know it was a Nora Ephron film.
Right?
Because it sort of, compared to her other films, it's sort of like, it just doesn't feel like a Nora movie. I don't know. It's odd, but.
Yeah, that's another one of those blockbuster as a kid movies. It just always was around John Travolta with the
long hair.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw it a lot because my mom loves Michael. So I saw it like a lot. I mean, it was probably
never
like our first Nora Ephron film, but. Well, it's our next movie that we're covering on the podcast Around the Corner. So you'll have to, check the movie out before you have a listen, but
for sure,
yes. But we did, you know, it's a good movie. It's just when looking at it through a Nora lens, it's a bit odd, but it is a good film.
Well, we are Nora Ephron stans, and we also stan the podcast Around the Corner.
We just had our first birthday in September, so
that's
really exciting. It's been such a fun year of, you know, I mean, I've been a Nora Ephron fan pretty much my whole life, but yeah, there's so much more that I'm finding out about her and other films that I hadn't seen. And like another one of Nora's films that's probably one of my new favorites is This Is My Life. It was her directorial debut, and it's just a really wonderful movie. But a lot of people haven't heard of that one, but definitely check that one out because it's just like straight out the gate. It's like she was just a perfect director straight away, and it's so Nora, that whole.
She makes no jokes.
No. She just, like, everything was, like, you know, hits. Even Mixed Nuts, which a lot of people are mean about that, but...
I've never seen that one either, but it looks like it'd be entertaining.
We're definitely team mixed nuts, Dan and I, because a lot of people are anti-mixed nuts, but we like
it.
It's fun. It's zany. It's based on a French farce. It's Christmas. It's Nora.
Steve Martin. Well, where can we find you and the podcast Around the Corner?
You can find the podcast Around the Corner. We're still on Twitter. Who knows how long that's going to last. I feel like I say this all the time, but like Twitter might implode. But yeah, we're on Instagram and Twitter. But Instagram's definitely the place to be. That's where I post most of our kind of fun extra content and stuff. But yeah, we're just at the Nora Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can also find us on the Cage Club Network website, which is cageclub.me. So yeah, all our episodes are on there. And we're also wherever you find your podcasts.
Cool beans. Well,
and you also have a lovely Twitter and Instagram, personally.
Thank you. My personal Instagram is private, but I am on Twitter at Shawnee Mead. And I'm pretty much either tweeting about Nora or Halloween. That's pretty much all I've got right now.
It's a vibe. I love it. So big fan. Thank you so much, Shawnee, for coming on. And we should do it again anytime, girl.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you so much for inviting me. It's like when you invited me and said I could pick the film, I was like, oh my God, it's exciting. And, Moonstruck just stuck out to me as a perfect choice. But so thank you. And I love your show as well. I'm a big fan.
Thank you. Thank you for being on. And thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye. Bye.
Huda Media Production.